We're going to talk all about Venezuela. So for starters, let's talk about, here we go. This is the comprehensive geopolitical breakdown on Venezuela. Send it to your friends, whoever. This is everything you need to know. I've done a ton of research on this. I've talked about it for months. And now the time has finally arrived. So first, let's actually talk about this operation and what happened. 2 weeks ago, after a major U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean on the coast of Venezuela, finally the United States launched a major airstrike involving over 150 aircraft to take out anti-aircraft systems on the ground in Venezuela. Then helicopters moved in, U.S. soldiers rappelled down into the fortified compound of the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro. They encountered heavy resistance from Maduro's personal security forces, many of them Cuban intelligence. Over 80 of them were killed in the raid. They captured Nicolas Maduro and his wife, transported them to New York City. Guantanamo Bay, I think, was a stop also. And they've charged Maduro with a number of things, drug trafficking, weapons trafficking, and they're currently holding him in New York City. So far, here we are 2 weeks later, it doesn't look like there are going to be any other military strikes. The president said that initially there was a second wave of airstrikes planned, which would have been much more ambitious, wider in scope, more intense. And he said that that second wave was canceled. It was deemed unnecessary. That being said, President Trump announced the morning following the raid that the United States will administer the government of Venezuela directly. And it seems since that announcement, it has been revealed that it will be administered through negotiations with Maduro second in command, his vice president. And if this vice president, now the newly appointed president, does not accede to the United States demands, then we will go in with further military action. That's where things stand right now. And this is a story from the New York Times about the raid. I'll read it to you. It says, quote, "The United States carried out a large-scale strike against Venezuela in which Mr. Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, were captured. General Dan Kane, otherwise known as Raising Kane," which I'm not making that up. I guess that's his nickname. General Raising Kane's chairman of, it's kind of like a weird meme magic. Because I had a clip from this show go viral talking about Raising Cane's. Did anybody else catch this synchronicity? And then they do a press conference, and I thought I was tripping, but they said General Raising Cane's is going to tell us more. I was like, did he just say Raising Cane's? Are they watching the show? But I guess that's his nickname. Anyway, General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, said that Mr. Trump ordered the operation late Friday, 2 weeks ago. The mission, which took about 2 hours and 20 minutes, involved 150 aircraft that worked to dismantle Venezuelan air defenses to clear a path for military helicopters carrying troops to Caracas, the capital city. Nearly 200 special operations forces took part in the raid. U.S. forces encountered significant resistance, said President Trump. At least 80 people were killed, including military personnel and civilians, according to a senior Venezuelan official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe preliminary reports. Cuban state media reported that 32 Cubans were killed in the U.S. attack. President Miguel Diaz-Canel of Cuba said they were from Cuba's armed forces or its interior ministry. No Americans were killed. Two special operations soldiers who were injured in the raid remain hospitalized but are recovering, said the Pentagon. Five other service members who suffered injuries in the operation have returned to duty. So in the first place, we have to say, can I just say, I take immense pride in this operation as an American, and I really don't understand how you can't. Because this is such a sophisticated, such an ambitious, such an awesome exercise of military force. I really question what kind of person you are if you can't take pride in it just by itself. Forget for a moment about the significance of it, the ramifications, the ideological or moral dimension. Forget about all that for just a second. My first reaction when I saw this, because I woke up in the morning a few hours after it took place, I felt pride as an American because no other country can do this. This is a level of joint operations combining Navy, Air Force, Special Forces. No other country on earth can do anything like this. It's awesome. We parked an aircraft carrier, 20,000 troops off the coast for 6 months. We lit up their boats, lit up their territory. And then like lightning, we went in 2 hours. Air defenses turned off. Internet, literally the lights, the electrical grid turned off. 150 aircraft flying constantly from aircraft carriers to shut down all the radar, drown out all the sound. We go in, we catch him. We literally pulled him out of his bed in his pajamas like a fucking bitch. Do you know how oralist that is? How do you not love that as an American? Because, look, I get some of the arguments against this. You say this is American empire. People say this is unnecessary. This is warmongering, this, that, or the other. At the end of the day, this is a criminal regime. They're literally socialists. People are saying this is a Catholic country. Okay, nominally. But it's a socialist country. It's built on this people's revolution. It's a bunch of corrupt gangsters. The country literally runs on drug trafficking, kidnapping, selling what little oil they can even get out of the ground. It's literally run by brown, criminal, socialist gangsters. And this pissant guy is on TV. I'm talking about Maduro. Is saying, come and get me. Come and get me. Oh, you're a coward. You'll never do it. Knock, knock. United States of America, bitch. We come in literally in the middle of the night, take the covers off the bed, and we pull him and his wife out of the bed in the middle of the night in their pajamas. She's got a black eye. Just punch his wife for good measure. Like a fucking bitch. Load him up on the helicopter. Deliver him to the emperor in a sack. Delivered to Guantanamo Bay and then the Imperial City in a fucking bag for the president of the United States. Kicked. Falls out of the bag. Looks up. Yeah, that's the president of the world, bro. So I know that's a little LARPy. I know, you know, maybe people say that's LARPy and performative and all that. I like that. And I have to say, it does reflect something deeper because, and this is actually very important and very serious, there are a lot of people in this anti-Israel coalition who are ideological liberals, pro-democracy, pro-pause liberals. There are people in the anti-Israel coalition who are ideologically Muslim theocrats, orientalists. And it is a matter for them of dogmatic faith politically that they view the past 500 years of European domination as like a crime or a fluke. They hate it. The British Empire, the French Empire, the Russian Empire, the German, Portuguese empires, the Dutch Empire. They view all of that and they hate it. Like on a deep level, they're angry about it. Still, I saw a talk by Jeffrey Sachs, who is one of these liberal Jews. He's on Judge Napolitano every morning. Tucker Carlson glazes him on his show. Jeffrey Sachs worked in the Clinton administration. This guy is like a prototypical liberal globalist, like a democratic globalist would be his conviction. Those are his ideas. Now, this guy hates Netanyahu, and he is opposed to what Israel is doing in Gaza. And for this reason, he's being welcomed onto Napolitano, Tucker, people in our space follow him. I saw a talk from him last week. He was at some Eurasia summit in Serbia. And he gets up and says, you know, for 500 years, European countries have dominated the globe as if there are no smart or good people in Asia and Latin America. He says, finally, finally, that era of history is coming to an end. Finally, China and India and Africa and all the peoples of the third world are telling the West, no. And the West is going to have to learn to get along. They're going to have to go to the back of the line and take a number at the United Nations. And this is what a lot of these people believe. And I believe that your reaction to this operation in Venezuela kind of tells you what side you're on from the point of view of identity. One of my favorite heuristics or axioms that I like to say on this show is that we have to learn to take our own side. What does that mean? Who are you? Where were you born? Where were your parents born? What color is your skin? What religion are you? Me? The color of my skin is white. I was born in America. My parents were born in America. Three out of four of my grandparents, their ancestors came from Europe. European domination of the globe is good for me as a Christian, American, mostly European person. Why would I want to vilify my own people? Why would I vilify my ancestors? Why would I look at them not as villains, as the villains of history? Why would I celebrate that our power as Europeans, as Americans, as Christians is diminishing relative to other people, relative to people who are born in other countries that are not Christian, that have a different complexion, that have a different clan? Why would I celebrate that? Look at the people that carried out the Delta Force operation in Venezuela. They're all white. Okay? And so I look, there are a lot of these types out there, ideological liberals, socialists, Islamists, and they love to see Western countries, European countries, America, they love to see these countries lose. And they put flags of foreign brown countries in their bio, Burkina Faso, Palestine, Iran, Venezuela. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't want America to make an empire for Israel in the Middle East. I want America to make an empire in the world for us, for me, for my posterity, in the tradition of my ancestors. And when I see that kind of exercise of power by the United States, I'm proud that the country that I pay taxes to, the country with a passport that I have, is able to do these things. It makes me feel proud. It makes me feel safe. It makes me feel good, and I'm glad. And there's a lot of people out there that are seething because they literally just hate to see America have power. And it's not all of them, but it's a lot of them. It's not every single person that didn't like it, but it's a lot of people that didn't like it. They have a reflexive anti-American, anti-European view because they have an ideological hangup. They want to see white Christian countries, ostensibly, historically, nominally, they want to see those countries diminished, and they sort of get off on it. I saw people saying they wanted for Venezuela's S-300 and S-400 Russian air defense systems to shoot down American jets. Like, they were giddy about this, gleeful. They said, oh, America's not ready. When we go in, they're going to encounter Venezuelan resistance. They're going to get fed into a meat grinder, guerrilla warfare from who? From socialist brown thugs? And you want that to happen? Why? Because Trump didn't ask Ilhan Omar for permission? Because he didn't go to the United Nations and beg Burundi and the Central African Republic? And I think there's something borderline treasonous about that. I think it's anti-American. It's one thing to say this is an operation that isn't in America's interest. Fine. It's one thing to say there are some concerns about the exercise of executive power, like whatever. But if your instinctual first response is not to take pride in America's capabilities, we were able to pull this off. I just don't really know what kind of person you are. It's kind of epic. I like it. It makes me feel good. I like that America's winning. I like that America's an empire. I like when we do these things. We show the world that we're decisive and bold, capable of swift action. I like it. And so anyway, that is the operation, okay? And we all know what happened at this point. So Trump kidnaps Maduro. Now the question is, to what end? Why did this happen? Who benefits is always the next question. Who loses? And much has been said about why we did this. Let's start first and foremost with the United States government. So like any kinetic action, like any military intervention, any war, the U.S. government gave a pretext, a justification for why we carried out this action. And it's the same justification as all the other operations against Venezuela, the attacks on these alleged drug trafficking dinghies in the Caribbean waters off the coast of Venezuela, for the apparently the only ground strike against a port in Venezuela, which apparently was trafficking cocaine. The pretext for this entire operation in Venezuela, which goes back many months at this point, is all about drug trafficking. You might remember this from about a year ago. Trump gets in and says that the new problem in Latin America and the Caribbean is what he calls narco-terrorism, that these Latin American countries traffic drugs like fentanyl and cocaine and other things into the United States at our ports across the border. And he takes it a step further. He says this constitutes an act of terrorism. And specifically, he's talking about fentanyl. Why? Because theoretically, you could say that because fentanyl is so deadly at such small doses that it resembles something like a biological or chemical weapon. And so there's an effort made to reclassify fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction, which theoretically you could make that case. When you see how much fentanyl is required to kill somebody, you wonder why this is not being used in legitimate acts of terrorism or by some sort of state actor, because it's kind of scary. I think legally speaking, though, this is ridiculous. You know, you could argue theoretically that makes sense. I don't think legally that's going to stand. But this is the argument. They say that these countries are trafficking drugs into the United States. It is killing tens of thousands of people. The types of drugs are so deadly and dangerous. This constitutes a form of terrorism. This is the pretext to authorize U.S. military force anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. There's been talk about strikes in Mexico, strikes in Colombia, in Venezuela, elsewhere. And they're saying that we get to do this because they're terrorists trafficking drugs into the country. And that's why they bombed the ships. That's why they bombed that port. That's why they kidnapped Maduro. And those are the charges that were brought against him. Now, speaking on this, a lot of people have pointed out that this is basically a phony pretext, that this entire operation and all of the airstrikes which preceded it are a phony pretext to legitimize something the government was already going to do for other reasons. Why? Well, let's start with the fact that Venezuela does not really traffic fentanyl into the United States. The fentanyl is made in China. It's trafficked into the United States through Mexico, almost all of it. So there is no Venezuela fentanyl problem. They say, well, Venezuela traffics cocaine. And that is true. Venezuela is a somewhat major node in the international trafficking of cocaine. But Venezuela traffics almost all the cocaine that is produced or held in their territory in the West to Europe. Most of the cocaine that is moved eastward from Colombia into Venezuela is trafficked out to Europe. Not a lot of it makes its way into the United States. So in terms of a drug problem, this is basically a made-up pretext. This is not real. There is no real Venezuela drug trafficking problem, certainly not with fentanyl. With cocaine, this is embellished and totally exaggerated to the point that it doesn't even make any sense. But this is what they're using, they say, because the Venezuelan regime makes its money off of the trafficking of drugs. They say with these criminal enterprises like the Cult of the Sun and Tren de Aragua, they say that throughout the government, the drug trafficking is embedded in the regime, that members of the regime actually carry on their state functions with the proceeds and revenue from the sale of drugs. So this is how they criminalize the regime. And this is how they legitimize and in a way then legalize what they're doing, which is bombing the ships, implementing this blockade of Venezuelan trade and oil, and ultimately the capture of Maduro. So that's not really why we did it. That's why the government is saying we did it. That's not really why we did it. I would like to say on this fact, I've seen people like Dave Smith and others who I like. You know, I like Dave. He is a libertarian, for what it's worth. They have said that this makes it an illegal war. And they're mad. They're saying, we were sold this intervention with a lie. Now, and I'm not going to, I'm going to try not to be mean here because I like Dave, but this is just how the world works. This is how all interventions, all wars in the entire history of the world are sold, especially and in particular in the age of mass democracy. In order for a country to do anything, it needs to come up with an excuse. It needs to come up with a reason based in an ideal that goes beyond what is in our self-interest. That being said, every country acts in its self-interest. Every country, its commercial policy, its foreign policy, its security policy, all of a country or a government's policies are based out of self-interest for the regime, if not for the country at large. And every country will couch those arguments for those interventions in idealistic or ideological terms. They'll say it's for democracy promotion. They'll say it's anti-colonialism. They'll couch it in religious language. They'll say it's a jihad or a crusade. This is always how the world has worked. So this does not make it unlike any other intervention in history. And so, therefore, we have to judge it based on the only reasonable standard, which is it in our interest or not? The government is going to say anything about it. They will come up with any excuse, any pretext, and that doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't even need to. It needs to be convenient for the purpose of having the government carry it out and getting the public to acquiesce to the policy, or the world for that matter, to acquiesce to the policy. It needs to be passable. So if the fundamental axiom is a state is going to do something that is in its best interest, and if this pretext about drug trafficking is not real, it raises a question, what is the real reason then? The real reason, not the pretext, that we went into Venezuela. What was the national interest that was served in carrying out the operation? And there's a ton of speculation about this. And I want to start first and foremost with this argument about oil. This is what everybody focuses on. Venezuela is one of the major petroleum exporting countries of the world. Founding member of OPEC, the oil and petroleum exporting cartel. Venezuela is a petrostate. So most of their government revenue is funded by the sale of oil. They sell most of their oil to China, which is a U.S. adversary. And so with all of this escalation and with the force posture assembled in the Caribbean, everybody thinks, of course, the reason we have kidnapped Maduro, and based on some of what the president has said also, the national interest that was served here is taking control of that oil supply. And let's talk a little bit about the oil. It is important to acknowledge that Venezuela is not one of the biggest oil producers in the world in terms of how much oil they produce every single day. Venezuela is actually underperforming. They produce about 800,000 to a million barrels of oil per day. For context, there's about 105 million barrels of oil produced in the world every day. So if there's 105 million barrels per day being produced in the world, and Venezuela accounts for 800,000 to 1 million of those barrels, that is less than 1% of global oil production. By far and away, the biggest oil producers are the United States, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, and they blow Venezuela out by 20, 10, 5 times that. So why is Venezuela attractive for oil? It's because they have the largest proven oil reserves. According to some estimates, they say it's 300 billion barrels of oil in Venezuela. According to other estimates by the U.S. Geological Survey, it could be as much as a trillion barrels of oil. And so the question of Venezuela's oil is really in its untapped potential. There's going to be no immediate effect on Venezuelan oil production in the world. Specifically, let's think about it from the point of view of geopolitics. A lot of people said that the United States invaded Venezuela either to, one, deprive China of the oil they get from Venezuela, or two, and obviously this goes hand in hand, so that the United States can start receiving the oil that Venezuela produces. But again, you got to go back to the numbers. China imports about 11 million barrels of oil per day. They only import about 600,000 of those barrels from Venezuela, so it's about 4%. So Venezuela makes less than 1% of the world's oil every day. China imports less than 4%. Less than 4% of their imports is coming from Venezuela. So if the goal of the United States in taking Venezuela's leader and seizing control of the oil fields, if the goal was to have some immediate effect on either the global price of oil or on the supply of oil to China, this is going to have a negligible impact. Let's talk about on the side of the United States. The United States could always import Venezuelan oil, and we always have. The United States will sanction Venezuelan oil at will. Sometimes we buy it, sometimes we don't, and that's based on our political posture towards Venezuela, whether we're more aggressive or not. Under the first Trump administration, we put heavy sanctions on Venezuela's oil in 2019. We wouldn't buy it. When Biden got elected, he gave Venezuela a waiver from the sanctions, and we started importing it. So we could always have access to Venezuela's oil, and they would have been happy to sell it to us. Last year, our special envoy to Venezuela, Rick Grenell, actually negotiated a deal where they would sell us their oil. They would give us even their critical mineral mines, their gold mines. We could make money from their existing mines, and we would be able to take advantage of future prospects if we did a proper survey and found out the true mineral wealth of the country. So the real question about Venezuela's oil, it is not about whether we have access to it. It's not a question of whether we're depriving China of a particularly important source of oil. They'll just get more from Russia or other countries. It's not a question of putting downward pressure on global oil prices to hurt countries like Russia. So people say, the real reason we took over Venezuela is that future potential. What is the situation in Venezuela? It hasn't always been the case that they produced only 800,000 to a million barrels per day. Back in the 1990s, they produced 3.5 million barrels per day. But the reason it's gone down over the past 25 years is because of mismanagement, corruption. They don't service their existing oil wells. They don't do what is necessary to maintain the infrastructure. So at one time, they were producing 3.5 million barrels per day. They thought they might produce over 6 million barrels per day. And there's that, you know, number again, 270, you know, but at one time, 3.5 million, and they thought they could go up to 6 million. Now they're down to 800,000. So the corollary to all of this, people say, well, the United States is going to bring back American oil companies like ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips, and U.S. oil companies are going to invest billions of dollars to service the infrastructure and build new infrastructure. And if we could jack up Venezuela's oil production to 3 million barrels per day or 6 million barrels per day, then this is going to be a huge source of energy for the United States. That being said, the timeline to take advantage of the resources is many, many years. It's an open-ended question if that is going to happen at all. Trump convened a meeting of oil executives this past week, and they all said that at this point in time, they will not be investing billions of dollars in Venezuela. And the reason being is because there's a very bad environment in the country for enforcing or arbitrating contracts. If there's a dispute between the Venezuelan state and an American oil company, the American oil company has no recourse. They cannot enforce existing contracts. International arbitration has no power. And so what has happened a couple of times in the past few decades is the Venezuelan state will expropriate the assets of American oil companies without reimbursing them. And so these oil companies are not about to go in with their personnel, who they're putting at risk in terms of their safety and security, and they're not going to pour billions of dollars in if there's no guarantee that in the next administration or in 10 years, they're going to be able to see a return on investment. And that would be guaranteed by robust contract enforcement, international arbitration. There would actually have to be policy changes. None of that is guaranteed. It might be worked out in the future. Even if you're able to create an environment where contracts can be enforced, where there's international arbitration, the timeline to service or increase the infrastructure in Venezuela is years. And so there have been estimates done on this. There is one American oil company in Venezuela, Chevron. If this company gets some kind of investment, maybe they get a short-term guarantee, they say that on the early end, you're talking about in a year, 2 years, maybe Venezuela gets up to 1.5 million barrels per day. So we go up by 50%. You get up another 500,000 barrels per day, 500,000 to 700,000 barrels per day, depending on the estimate for how much they make now. And again, this is not a significant amount of oil production to affect the global price of oil. It's not a significant amount of oil for the United States. The only relevant strategic factor with the oil, there's two things. It's about what kind of oil Venezuela's making and where the oil's going, not with regard to China. So first and foremost, the kind of oil in Venezuela is what they call heavy sour crude oil compared to light or sweet crude oil. That talks about the chemistry of oil. Heavy and light refers to how viscous and thick it is. Sweet and sour refers to how much sulfur is in the oil. Why does this matter? It takes a different kind of infrastructure to process and refine heavy and sour oil versus light and sweet oil. The United States imports heavy and sour oil from Canada, from Mexico, and from Venezuela. In the 1990s, U.S. oil companies built a ton of refining infrastructure in the Gulf of Mexico and Texas and Louisiana, 18 refineries, because they anticipated that they would be getting this heavy sour oil from Mexico and from Venezuela. Mexico was making tons of oil. Venezuela was making tons of oil. And so they made this bet that in perpetuity, the United States would be getting its oil from these countries. It would be this particular kind of oil, and that requires this infrastructure to process and refine this oil, and it's a very intensive process. What happens in the mid-2000s is that many of Mexico's oil wells run dry, and the amount of oil they produce actually goes down considerably. The same thing happens in Venezuela. So what happens to all these refineries in the Gulf of Mexico that were built up, cost billions of dollars, took many years? This is a major capital investment. What do you do if there is a supply crunch? You're just not getting the oil from these countries that you anticipated. Canada comes in, and Canada increases their oil production and starts exporting it to the United States. And now the United States imports about 60% of its oil from Canada because this is the heavy sour crude that we need in Texas and Louisiana that it is efficient for this infrastructure to refine. And we actually take the light sweet crude that we get from the oil sands through fracking and we export that to other countries that have the appropriate infrastructure for that. So if Venezuela increases the amount of oil production from 800,000 to 1.5 million barrels per day, this is not going to affect global oil prices. It's not going to be a major issue for China. They'll just get more oil from Russia. But that slight increase and then maybe projected future increase, it is going to affect Canada. Canada actually becomes one of the biggest losers. We, right now, are reliant on Canadian heavy sour oil. This is why we're building all these pipelines to get their oil from Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico. But it is cheaper to transport oil from Venezuela on a ship from Venezuela to Mexico to a port than it is to bring it down from a pipeline. So what does that mean? It means that we're going to prefer Venezuelan oil. It's cheaper per barrel to transport. That means that that puts downward pressure on the price of oil that we buy from Canada. So the idea that Canada has leverage over our economy because of the kind of oil they make, this might hurt them in the short and intermediate term. So that's the first country that gets affected in terms of oil. The second country is Cuba. Cuba needs about 100,000 barrels of oil per day. They get 30,000 barrels from Venezuela. And they get it almost for free. And they get it because Venezuela and Cuba are ideological and political allies. Cuba is a communist country. Venezuela is a socialist country. And so for decades, there has been a transfer between these two countries. Cuba provides human capital like doctors, intelligence agents, other things. Venezuela gives them free or discounted oil. One of Trump's first demands of the new Venezuelan regime is that they stop sending oil to Cuba, and Trump has implemented a blockade of Venezuelan oil. So that is going to put immediate pressure on Cuba. Regardless of how much oil Venezuela makes, whether it gets to China, and that's an open-ended question, how much of it goes to the United States, how much more they might make, these are all questions for a later date. But as of right now, like today and in the near term, Cuba is deprived of about a third of its oil imports. And this speaks to, as I said earlier last year, the real geopolitical ambition in Venezuela is so much more broad than people believe. People are looking in a very narrow way at the Venezuelan regime, at Maduro, and they're saying, well, what about Maduro and what about Venezuela from a geostrategic point of view? And what about their oil production? And they're looking at it strictly, only narrowly at this one country. But this is ignoring that the Trump administration has a much more ambitious endgame in the Caribbean and in the Western Hemisphere at large. Talk about the Western Hemisphere a little bit later, but in the first place, you have one of the most powerful secretaries of state in the modern American era right now with Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio is the Secretary of State, and as of spring 2025, he is also the National Security Advisor and leads the National Security Council. Mike Waltz from Florida was appointed to that position. He was dismissed. Rubio was appointed as an acting national security advisor and replaced him. So Rubio is a very powerful secretary of state. As some of you might know, Marco Rubio is from the state of Florida. He is a Cuban American. His parents are Cuban refugees. Technically, they fled the U.S.-backed government of Cuba, not the communists, which is kind of funny. Nevertheless, he's a Cuban refugee. He has very strong feelings about the Cuban regime. And you can imagine that it is his personal ambition that the Cuban regime gets overthrown. And so attacking Venezuela was never just about Venezuela. It was also always about Cuba and Nicaragua. It was about Venezuela's socialist allies in the Caribbean and in Central America that are dependent on Venezuela's oil. And so this is like a reverse domino theory. If you take down Venezuela, then you can carry that over to Cuba for a variety of reasons. One, because there's pressure from energy. Two, there's a ripple effect of kidnapping the leader. And the ripple effect is that an adversary like Cuba is going to look at this and wonder, is our president next? But also allies like Mexico are going to say the same thing. Do we want an increased U.S. presence in our country? And what this produces is cooperation. Unlike oil, this is intangible. You can quantify oil. You cannot specifically quantify cooperation. What Trump did in Venezuela was send a message that it would be better for Mexico to cooperate with the White House than not. And so Cuba's other major partner in the oil trade is Mexico. There's more pressure on Cuba rallying our allies against our adversaries. but also in Havana. The Cuban leadership is wondering if they're going to get airstrikes in their country, if they're going to get black bagged in the middle of the night. And there's the pressure coming from Venezuela and Mexico not sending their oil. So this is the ambitious agenda. This is actually the true oil politics in this theater of conflict. It has nothing to do in terms of oil with China, or less to do with that. It has less to do with America getting the oil, unless you're talking about a longer term investment, which is somewhat unreliable. The immediate effects are going to be felt by Canada, and they're going to be felt by Cuba. So that's oil. Now, there's some has been said about critical minerals and gold. I would say that that is a non-factor. Venezuela's mineral wealth is unexploited. There's no infrastructure. There's no investment. The preliminary stages have not even been conducted. It's questionable whether there are significant reserves of minerals and what the quality of the minerals are. In terms of bang for your buck, you're better off looking at Ukraine, Congo, Greenland, Canada, than you are looking at Venezuela. So some people have talked about Venezuela allegedly has these untapped gold reserves from the ground. Some of these numbers have been conflated with the amount of gold in Venezuela's government, the actual physical gold they hold as currency. And there has been some said about bauxite and other minerals, but again, that's probably very low on the totem pole in terms of priorities. This is the last thing I want to talk about, and then we're going to get into that real reason. So a lot of people have also said that what this represents is neoconservatism. People are saying that this is a neoconservative intervention. I have been called neocon Nick for supporting it. They say it's just another neocon war. What is neoconservatism? Neoconservatism, ostensibly, is an ideology. And the reason I say ostensibly is because it is layered. There is an exoteric version of neoconservatism, what it says it is, and then there is an esoteric reading of neoconservatism, which is what it actually is, and which it does not tell people, and which obviously many people have come to understand about neoconservatism. So what do I mean by this? Nominally, in name, and again, what neocons say to the world is that this is an ideology that is based on democracy promotion. Who are the neocons? What is a neocon? Neocon means a new conservative, a new kind of conservative. And they emerge in the late 1960s and early 1970s. They are all Democrats. Okay, the neoconservatives are all former Democrats. Former Democrats who are reacting to the radical new left, which is much more progressive, much more socialist. And one of the actions that creates the new conservatives that emerge from the liberals is the Soviet Union's invasion, or rather, the Soviet Union-backed Egyptian and Syrian invasion of Israel in 1973. The Israel-Arab War in 1967. And so all of these liberal Democrats in New York City, in New York, who lives in New York, all of these liberal Democrats, they see that the communist Soviet Empire is working to destroy Israel. And they're working to destroy Israel politically and militarily. Politically by putting forth resolutions in the Security Council and the General Assembly, calling Israel a racist country and Zionism racist, but also because they're backing Israel's enemies, which could theoretically destroy Israel and almost did on a few occasions. And so all of these liberal Democrats from New York City, Jews, who are writing these intellectual magazines and going to intellectual salons, they get very jaded about the left. They get jaded about the Soviet Union. And they realize if Israel is going to make it, the Soviet Union has to be destroyed. Because the Soviet Union is backing all of Israel's enemies. The Soviet Union is propping up the new left, which is calling Israel racist and undermining the foundations of Israel. So these liberal Democrats from New York, these Jews, they flip sides. Now they maintain all their liberal politics. They're still in favor of mass migration. They're in favor of the free market. They're in favor of racial integration. They're in favor of feminism, all these things. The only thing is they now want to destroy the Soviet Union. And how do they justify it? They say we need to promote democracy. How do we roll back the Soviet Union and its communist tentacles? We have to be in the business of democracy promotion, promoting free markets, promoting a liberal system. And so they say wherever the Soviet Empire touches, like in Vietnam or in Nicaragua or wherever, we need to plant the flag of democracy and the free market. And this carries on through the Cold War into the 1990s, the 2000s, and the neocons are still preoccupied with the Middle East and Israel. And so what do they start to say in the 90s and 2000s? They say we need to bring democracy to the Middle East because it's a strategically important region and it's going to really count here. And if we plant the flag of a democracy, we're going to transform the region into a place that is allied with the United States. They pick all of Israel's worst enemies, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and this is where they want to promote their democracies. And the goal was to destroy these regimes, which are pan-Arab or Islamist, and replace the regimes, kill the leaders, kill the officer class, prosecute all the bureaucrats, and create new countries, new states, new security architecture with new people that are ideologically liberal, capitalist, pro-democracy. And that's what they did in Iraq. And that's what they're trying to do in Syria. That's what they're trying to do in Iran right now. Like I said, there is an exoteric, meaning an outside reading, and there is an esoteric, a hidden inside meaning. The outside meaning of neoconservatism is that the American flag represents democracy, freedom, free markets, liberalism, and we need to turn the world into a democracy to make it safe for America and safe for diversity and liberalism and religious pluralism. And that is what they tell people, and that is how they get white people to support this. The deeper meaning, of course, is that this is a farce. This is a pretext, just like drugs in Venezuela. It's not really about democracy promotion. We work with Saudi Arabia. The neocons work with Saudi Arabia, which is an Islamic theocracy. The neocons work with the current regime in Syria, which is run by Al-Qaeda. And it is going to be an Islamist state. It's like the Taliban. So they don't really mean that. And they don't really care about democracy or free markets or liberalism. The real reason they're saying this is to justify U.S. interventions that are important to Israel. And those are the ones that we've been fighting near Israel's borders for 25, 30 years. Iraq, most notably, but also all the other theaters you now know about. So, question, is Venezuela a neoconservative intervention? Well, let's talk about it. So what did we do in Venezuela? Did we, strictly speaking, pursue a regime change policy in Venezuela? Did we change the regime? Some people might say the obvious answer is yes. I think I saw Michael Tracy and Glenn Greenwald. They said, no one can argue that Trump isn't in favor of regime change. But did we change the regime? What is a regime? What is the regime in Venezuela? The regime in Venezuela is called Chavista. That's the style and the form of the regime that was brought to power by Hugo Chavez when he was elected in 98 and with the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. It's a socialist, gangsterish cult of personality based on redistribution, using their oil wealth to pay for social services. What else is the regime? It is not only the president, but it is their civilian leadership, and it is the military leadership. It is the security forces. It is, for example, the very powerful defense minister and interior minister. Now ask yourself, here we are 2 weeks later. Did the regime change? And it's sort of a trick question. Because while Nicolas Maduro was kidnapped and removed from the country, the rest of the regime remains completely intact. It is totally still there. Maduro's vice president became the president. The interior minister remained. The defense minister remained. Every government minister remained. And the security services remain. The security services that are loyal to this Chavista government, this socialist government, they all remain too. We didn't go in and arrest everybody. We didn't do re-education. We didn't do a loyalty test. We didn't put on trial the whole leadership class or military leadership. One person was removed, and the second in line moved up. And you could say, well, what difference does it make? They took the president. We did not do this in Iraq. We did not do this in Syria. We did not do this in Afghanistan. We did not do this in any of those countries. When the United States invaded Iraq, we didn't just take out Saddam Hussein and let his Ba'athist officers and loyalists pick up the pieces. We took out Saddam. We tried to eradicate and de-Ba'athify. That was the ruling one party in Iraq. We tried to de-Ba'athify the entire country and turn it into a democracy with elections. In other words, in terms of personnel, concretely, but also in terms of the character of the state, we tried to change the regime. Same in Afghanistan. Did we take out the leader of the Taliban and then let the Taliban keep running their theocracy? No, we tried to get women to vote there. We tried to build a regime with tribal alliances and have elections, and it would be a liberal state run by different people. Same thing in Syria. Same thing in Libya. It was a full regime change. This is something approximating a decapitation strike, but only in the narrowest possible terms. And by the way, this is not just me saying this. This is not a theory. Some people might say, well, that's cope. You're desperate. You're just making excuses. The actual neoconservatives who are still around, they say exactly the same thing. Bret Stephens, the Jewish columnist at the New York Times who trained Barry Weiss. He comes from the Jerusalem Post. He is one of the most well-known prominent neoconservatives in American public life. This is what he had to say about it. He said, quote, "There are good reasons to celebrate the downfall of the tyrant Maduro, as so many Venezuelan exiles did when they heard the news Saturday morning. Not among those reasons, an America that seizes Venezuela's oil assets while keeping what is left of Maduro's odious regime in place. Whether failing to remove the regime is a possibly disastrous oversight or part of a yet-to-be-revealed plan, the administration will have to figure out how to get rid of it for good in favor of a legitimate, stable, democratically elected government, and it will have to offer Americans and the rest of the world an explanation for why it did so." So this is one of the leading neocons. Yes, he is a Jew. You don't have to check the early life. He comes from the Jerusalem Post. He was at the Murdoch-controlled Wall Street Journal. He is the mentor of Barry Weiss. He is a columnist at the New York Times, the paper of record of the United States. And he wrote the day after the operation, he said, well, you know, there's some reasons to be happy, but I'm not going to be happy until it's regime change and we get a stable, democratically elected government. And until that happens, you need to explain why you didn't. So they don't think it's the neocons don't consider it regime change because it isn't. Here's another one. This is Elliot Abrams. Elliot Abrams is another, he's a legend of the neocons, another Jew, a Straussian, worked in the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, the Trump administration in the first term. Elliot Abrams is one of the architects of Clean Break, the war in Iraq. Elliot Abrams was interviewed by Ross Douthat at the New York Times, and this is what he said. He said, quote, "I was arguing for a policy of regime change. We don't have that policy. The regime is still in place in Caracas fully. And the front man, Delcy Rodriguez, is being accepted by the United States. She is surrounded by indicted drug trafficking criminals who are still in place. So I would like to hear more from the administration about how we move from this moment to democracy in Venezuela. We've heard the word elections from the president, from the Secretary of State, but we've heard nothing about how and why they think this bunch of criminals is going to commit suicide by leading to a democratic transition." So these are two of the leading Jewish neocons in American public life, and they both say this is unsatisfactory, this is not a regime change, this is not what we asked for. And why? because they plucked Maduro out, but the security forces, the rest of the regime is completely intact. Well, let's look at who took Maduro's spot. It's Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez. She's a Chavista. She's a socialist. The intelligence services are loyal to her. Do you know what she said about the operation to remove Maduro? This is what she said according to the Jewish Forward magazine. Venezuela's acting leader, in an address to the nation on Sunday, said there were Zionist undertones to the U.S. military's capture of Nicolas Maduro. Delcy Rodriguez, a vice president under Maduro, who is now the interim leader, has demanded the immediate release of Maduro and his wife since they were captured by U.S. forces on Saturday. Maduro and Flores were flown to New York City, where they are expected to appear in federal court on drug trafficking and other charges on Monday. She said, quote, "Governments around the world are simply shocked that the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela is the victim and target of an attack of this nature, which undoubtedly has Zionist undertones." So why do you think Bret Stephens and Elliot Abrams are unhappy that it wasn't a complete regime change? I'll tell you why. This is like what played out in Argentina back in 2023. In 2023, you had a Peronist, socialist, left-wing candidate running for president of Argentina. He was going to put Argentina in BRICS. He was sympathetic to Palestine, among other things. The United States backed his challenger, Javier Milei. Milei is a U.S. loyalist. Among other things, he's aspirationally Jewish. He says he wants to be a Jew. He's pro-Israel. When he won the election, he visited Chabad Lubavitch headquarters in Brooklyn, New York. Then he visited Israel. He cried at the Wailing Wall. Argentina is one of the only countries now that votes with the United States, with Israel, in the United Nations. So why do you think that Elliot Abrams and Bret Stephens want a full democratic transition in Venezuela? Because they want Maria Corina Machado, who is the leader of the Venezuelan opposition, who is pro-Israel, just like Javier Milei. They want her to be the president. They want democracy. They want elections. They want the CIA and the National Endowment for Democracy to make her the president so that she can give everything to the CIA and start supporting Israel. But Trump said she's not up for the job. This is what Trump said about Maria Corina Machado. He said, quote, asked on Saturday if he thought Machado could run the country, Trump distanced himself from their most visible Democratic figure, saying it would be very tough for her. He said she's a nice woman, but she doesn't have the respect within the country. And so here is the tension. It's a subtle tension between a completely neoconservative foreign policy and, you could say, a Jacksonian, realist, pro-America foreign policy. What are the neoconservatives interested in? Again, exoterically, extrinsically, democracy promotion, nation building, regime change. That is, in name, what the neocons want. They want America to invade countries, kill all the strongmen dictators, and force a democratic transition, and the country is run by the CIA and the government's pro-Israel. And Israel can send the Jews there, and the Jews can infiltrate that country. That's what they want. Of course, esoterically, intrinsically, what the Jews want is to create more allies for Israel with a focus on the Middle East. They want the United States to destroy all these regimes. Specifically, they want the United States to cause so much destabilization, turmoil, chaos. They want to fracture these Middle Eastern countries so that they cannot come back together as a strong, coherent whole. They want us to not only destroy Iraq's government, but destabilize it so that Iraq is dismembered into three pieces, and without unification, they can never get a big military to challenge Israel. And they want America to invade all these countries and force a democratic transition so that Jewish election fixers and Mossad can penetrate those countries and secure their interests. Israeli firms, Jewish firms can come in and do their thing. What the United States is doing is subtly different, which under Trump. According to the National Defense Strategy, Trump said, our focus is not the Middle East. It's not even the Pacific. It's Latin America. Trump said, we have suffered from strategic neglect in the Western Hemisphere. We let it go. Now there are threats rising up in Central South America and the Caribbean. We need to address those things to create a hemispheric defense so that the entire hemisphere is defensible from foreign influence. And that doesn't necessarily entail democracy promotion. We don't care if Venezuela is a democracy as long as they bow to our leaders. We don't care if their government professes liberalism as long as they are our ally. We have their resources. We can tell them what to do. And again, the difference is in focus. Israel wants to escalate in Lebanon. They want us to escalate in Syria. They want us to escalate in Iran, in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Yemen. Venezuela is not really high on their list. In the same way that Iran doesn't threaten the United States, Venezuela doesn't threaten Israel. Do they like that the Venezuelan regime is pro-Palestine? Obviously not. But they would rather the United States bomb Tehran, obviously, than bomb Caracas. And they would rather Venezuela undergo a democratic transition, a CIA coup with some Zionist puppet, than have this kind of gunboat hostage situation with the remnant of the Maduro regime. So there are some subtle differences there. With that out of the way, I want to get into the real, this is a long show. I want to get into the real justification for the U.S. intervention in Venezuela. And this gets back to that subtle difference. A lot of people said, this is a war under false pretenses because of this pretext about drug trafficking. So it's a lie. A lot of people said this is neoconservatism. And so this is another useless war, an illegal war. They said it's contrary to international law or even constitutional law. All these arguments were given. Here is my unwavering axiom and why I would justify the intervention in Venezuela. It starts with America first. Okay, that's the name of the show. So the show is not called non-intervention. The show is not called isolation. It's not called UN. It's not called nationalism for all nations. Fuck the other nations and fuck the UN. It's called America first. Ideologically, I am a realist. What does that mean? It means the only imperative for any government, for any state, is to put its own people first. What is the only imperative of a U.S. government if we have a government? It is to ensure the safety and security and continuity of the United States of America. If it can't do that, if it isn't doing that, then it is not doing its job. That is the moral imperative. Survival is the imperative. Because if a nation doesn't survive, well, then it cannot do anything else. Just like a human being. My imperative as a human being is survival. I need to eat. I need to drink water. I need to defend myself if I'm under attack. I need to secure myself. And it goes beyond. If someone is pointing a gun at me, I shoot them first. We have houses with locks on our doors. We have situational awareness. We take precautions. Because as long as there are other people that we share the world with, they threaten us by their very existence. As long as there are other individuals that want the things that we want, whether it's resources, whatever, that they want more, we want more, it creates a security dilemma. As long as I am a man and there's another man and we go to embrace and shake hands, I'm worried he's got a rock behind his back. I'm worried that he's got a weapon behind his back. If another man has a weapon, I need a weapon. If I think he might have a weapon, he might be able to kill me. And if he can, he might, because he's thinking the same thing. And he thinks it might be safer to go and kill me first on the offhand chance that I'm plotting to kill him than to wait and take the chance. This is called a security dilemma. And so as long as there are governments, as long as there are states, they are in a ceaseless security dilemma. They're in a ceaseless calculation about how to secure their survival. And a nation is more complex than a person. A nation needs a lot of things. It needs an idea to keep all of the people together. A nation needs resources for a complex modern economy. It needs energy. It needs food. It needs certain minerals. It needs a lot of things. And so What is involved in U.S. foreign policy and military policy is the first question, is this in favor of the continuity and survival of the American nation? And it gets to be quite convoluted. We are a great power. We exist on the world stage among other countries that would like to be world powers. They want to be world powers because they want to be optimally secure. They want to be in the position of advantage. They are working to secure resources, territory. They want to have that primacy, that comfort of knowing that if it came down to it, they could win a conflict. And so, like I said, it gets to be quite convoluted. A lot of people like to say, well, America's a republic. If we're not attacked, then we shouldn't go and fight anybody. Well, America has interests pursuant to its survival that go beyond whether we're directly attacked. You know, this is what happens at Pearl Harbor. Japan is worried that we have this powerful Navy. We are watching these developments in Europe and Asia. They're worried that if they make some moves to secure oil, we might intervene. They launch a preemptive attack. We need to be making these chess calculations. We need to think 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 moves ahead. And we need to think about everything that a nation needs. Not just guns and ships, but everything that a nation might need. Pharmaceuticals, food, fertilizer. And we need to think about, in a hypothetical matchup, in a hypothetical war, how are we going to best be able to defend ourselves or launch a preemptive attack? And then we have to look at geography. This is the basis of geopolitics. So the show is called America First. I am a realist because, first and foremost, I believe our government should be looking out for Americans. If you have a U.S. passport, if you have U.S. citizenship, if you're a tax-paying American and you don't want to die, you want to secure resources and safety and, you know, all the things that a government can secure for its people. You want our country to be as powerful as possible. You want our country to look after our vital strategic interests. And so under that premise, I believe that, yes, sometimes war is justified. Yes, interventions, some small, all the way up to a total war, are necessary. It is necessary to have nuclear weapons. It is necessary to have a giant military bases. It is necessary to have these things, actually. I'm in favor of those things, as long as they are for survival, continuity, preservation of Americans. This has actually always been our doctrine, or at least it was from the very beginning. And when our founders set up the government, they took note of this. They acknowledged that our greatest asset as a fledgling republic, long before we industrialized, before we had a navy, before we had an army, before we were any kind of a power, forget about a global power, before we were even a regional power, a local power, the founding fathers knew that our great strategic asset is that we are protected by the oceans. We don't have to concern ourselves with what is happening in Europe or Asia, you know, Russia, the concert of powers in Europe, Napoleon, because they're never going to come all the way over here and invade us. And if they do, we have an advantage. They have to cross an ocean, and that involves logistics and resupply, and it's a difficult journey. We're right here. And so the founding fathers said, we should not go out into the world looking for monsters to destroy. We don't need to. We're blessed by the geography. We don't need to actually concern ourselves with the great power conflicts that are happening over there and the intrigue and the diplomacy and sometimes the wars. And they said, we should not pursue these types of alliances where we get entangled in them and we're committed permanently to other countries. Why would we? We're safe, so we should be flexible. Shortly after the country comes into existence, you get the promulgation of what is called the Monroe Doctrine by James Monroe, written by his personnel, John Quincy Adams. And this is delivered at the State of the Union. And I'll read it to you. This is in 1823. President James Monroe says, quote, "The occasion has been judged proper for asserting as a principle in which the rights and interests of the United States are involved, that the American continents, by free and independent condition, which they have assumed and maintain, are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization by any European powers." This goes back literally 200 years. You might have heard of it, the Monroe Doctrine, written by John Quincy Adams, stated by President James Monroe. He says, no European countries can colonize the Americas. And by the way, this is said when America does not even have the ability to enforce it. At this time, the United States is not any kind of military power. And look at the territory of the United States at this point. This is before the Mexican Cession. This is before a lot of the territorial gains. We don't have a navy. We don't have an army. We can't enforce this against Spain, against France, against the United Kingdom, against Russia. But it's a statement of principles. It's aspirational. It says that it's in our best interest that these European countries don't colonize the Americas. That's the only thing that can threaten us. Well, after the Civil War, the United States industrializes. After the Civil War, we lay down the railroad, we build factories, and we build the Navy. Our industrial might translates to wealth. Our productive capacity leads to wealth. Wealth leads to military power, specifically naval power. And suddenly we have the ability to enforce the Monroe Doctrine. And then we revise it. And so the Secretary of State, Richard Olney, for the President Grover Cleveland in 1895, modifies the Monroe Doctrine. They call this the Olney Interpretation, the Olney, O-L-N-E-Y. This is the corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. Now that we have a Navy, and now that we could actually do something, this is what he says. He reinterprets it at the turn of the last century. He says, quote, today the United States is practically sovereign on this continent, and its fiat, its decree, is law upon the subjects to which it confines its interposition. Why? It is not because of the pure friendship or goodwill felt for it. It is not simply by reason of its high character as a civilized state, nor because wisdom, justice, and equity are the invariable characteristics of the dealings of the United States. It is because, in addition to all other grounds, its infinite resources combined with its isolated position render it master of the situation and practically invulnerable as against any or all other powers. So what he's saying is we can do whatever we want. We are the most powerful country. We have infinite wealth. We're protected by the oceans. Nobody can challenge us. And so it is a matter of fact that what we say goes, because who can tell us otherwise? And this is then the basis for the Spanish-American War, where we fight to take Cuba from Spain, and we take the Philippines and Puerto Rico. And this is then the basis with the Roosevelt Corollary to intervene in all the banana republics in the Caribbean. And then this is the basis for the Truman Doctrine in the 40s and 50s to intervene in Central and Latin America against communist dictatorships. I will add, and this is sort of an interesting note, where does the phrase America First come from? Well, maybe its first historical iteration is the America First Committee, which formed up in the interwar period shortly before the United States entered World War II. And the America First Committee was a broad coalition. There were liberals, communists, leftists, but there were also fascists, rightists, German-American Bund. Lots of different people came together in the America First Committee to oppose U.S. entry into World War II, specifically the war in Europe, but also the war in the Pacific. And what was their argument? They said that even if the Nazis win, it doesn't matter. We're safe. They said it does not matter what the outcome of the war is in World War II. If the Axis wins, we'll be fine. They're not going to invade us. They can't. The original America First Committee, Henry Ford was a member. Charles Lindbergh was a member. JFK's father was a sympathizer. This is what they wrote about the Monroe Doctrine. They said, quote, this is a speech by Charles Lindbergh to the America First Committee in 1941. He said, there is a policy open to this nation that will lead to success, a policy that leaves us free to follow our own way of life, develop our own civilization. It is not a new and untried idea. It was advocated by Washington. It was incorporated in the Monroe Doctrine. Under its guidance, the United States became the greatest nation in the world. It is based upon the belief that the security of a nation lies in the strength and character of its own people. It recommends the maintenance of armed forces sufficient to defend this hemisphere from attack by any combination of foreign powers. It is a policy not of isolation, but of independence, not of defeat, but of courage. It is a policy that led this nation to success during the most trying years of our history. It is a policy that will lead us to success again. So even the original America First Committee was not against the Monroe Doctrine, not against hemispheric defense. Even they said, we don't want to fight in Europe. We don't want to fight in Asia, but fighting in the Western Hemisphere, well, that is what Americans do. It's what we've always done. We did it in the Mexican-American War. We did it in the Spanish-American War. We intervened all over the place. And as long as we have the requisite force to defend the hemisphere from any country or combination of countries, we'll be okay. We don't need to worry about the others. And so let's get into that strategic interest. What specifically does this mean? Practically for us, why did the United States intervene in Cuba in the 1890s? Why did they intervene again in the 1950s and in the 1960s? Why did they intervene in some of these Central American countries? It is because a large volume of trade moves through the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean Sea. Something like 40% in terms of volume, not dollar value, of American shipping goes through the Gulf of Mexico. And it goes through narrow choke points between Mexico and Cuba, between Cuba and Florida. How far is Cuba from Florida? It's about 90 miles. People have swam that distance. If there is a rival power in Cuba, in Venezuela, in Mexico, in any of these countries, they could reasonably threaten American shipping. They could potentially deploy weapon systems in reach of the United States. And obviously, that happened in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis when communist Cuba, after the failure of the Bay of Pigs, asked the Soviet Union for missiles to protect itself. And Nikita Khrushchev deployed nuclear missiles to Cuba within reach of the United States. And this is the most important 13 days in the Cold War. The Soviet Union put weapon systems 90 miles away from Florida that can carry weapons of mass destruction. This is why it is in our strategic interest. Russia is far away. China is far away. Europe, the Middle East, all of that is far away. This is our backyard. I don't think people realize the Caribbean is our backyard. That is where American shipping goes through. That is where transshipment occurs from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean through the Panama Canal. That's where our Navy goes. And all of these countries are a stone's throw away from the United States. What has been happening in Latin America for the past 25 years? Well, ever since China entered the World Trade Organization in 2001, they have made a concerted effort to impose their will in Latin America. And so what are they doing? They have enrolled the majority of Latin American countries in the Belt and Road Initiative. So they're building infrastructure in Latin American countries. Infrastructure like what? Deep water ports. They're building ports in Jamaica, in Mexico, in Cuba, in Venezuela, in Peru, in Ecuador, in Argentina. They're building ports. Why does that matter? The same deep water ports that can harbor, let's say, some of the largest commercial shipping vessels, the largest, when we are talking about shipping, they carry the most shipping containers. The same ports that can handle that can handle a People's Liberation Navy vessel. And what can you carry even on a commercial shipping vessel? You can carry a containerized missile system. What China has invented is a shipping container that contains an intermediate range missile launching platform. And it looks like a shipping container. It looks like any shipping container you see on a truck, on a barge. And inside of it concealed is a missile launch platform. You can put those on a commercial ship. And so there have been studies done by the Center for Strategic International Studies. They say that there are up to 38 ports China has all over the Caribbean, all over Latin America. They call it dual-use infrastructure. its infrastructure that can be used for commercial purposes, but also have the capability to have military purposes also. In terms of data collection, power projection, they could theoretically have a military vessel there. 38 of them, and some of them strategically placed in the Caribbean. And if you look at what is happening over in China, everybody knows that the clock is running out on a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. Xi Jinping and Beijing have said they have set a deadline for 2027. That is the latest or the earliest that they want to be prepared for China to invade Taiwan. So what? Why does that matter, people say? We have contained China for years by controlling a chain of islands that stretches from Japan in the north all the way down to Malaysia in the south and includes Taiwan. We have effectively boxed China in, controlling islands, making it so that the only way China can access the Pacific Ocean is through small choke points that we can monitor, that we can control. It's practical for us to do so. It's economical. If China takes Taiwan, and all signs point toward they're going to try and they will be successful, this is a breakout. China takes Taiwan, now the whole Pacific Ocean is wide open to them. Their submarines, aircraft carriers, destroyers. It'll be difficult to monitor. It'll be difficult to deter. And once they're wide open in the Pacific, who's to say they don't deploy strategic assets into Latin America? These are countries that have an enormous amount of debt to China. China is a partner or have an interest in these infrastructure projects. These infrastructure projects can be used against the United States, whether it's ports, it could also be radar dishes, space station. Some of it acts as actually sovereign soil. And now that China is the largest trading partner for a majority of Latin American countries, they can exert considerable political pressure over all of them. So it's like I said before, the immediate loser, the immediate effect of the intervention in Venezuela is Cuba. Excuse me. Cuba loses the oil. Cuba loses an ally. They are forced to the table to negotiate. This is part of a shorter-term domino theory approach to break the back of some of our worst adversaries in the Caribbean and Latin America. But the big picture here is that we are in World War III or World War IV, however you count them. We are currently engaged in a great power struggle with China. That's what all of this is about. And what the United States is doing is getting its strategic house in order. We have neglected Latin America for 25 years. The United States has allowed China to gain a foothold, in large part because we gave up. George W. Bush was focused on the Middle East. When Obama got in office, his Secretary of State, John Kerry, said, "The era of the Monroe Doctrine is over. We're not going to intervene in these countries." And so basically, while we were sleeping or while we were involved in Israel's wars, we let a dragon into our hemisphere. This is our fortress. This is our home base. This is all we got to worry about is these two continents, North and South America. That's where our trade occurs. That's where our supply chains are located. That's where our shipping happens. These are the important waterways. This is the important territory. This is what is proximate to us in our neighborhood. And while we were focused all the way over in Iraq and Afghanistan building a democracy, China was engaging in a trade offensive, an infrastructure and political offensive in these countries, peeling them away from us, planting a flag, such that if or when a breakout occurs in the Pacific, they could theoretically use it as a foothold against the United States. You don't have to worry about China if they are constrained within the first island chain. But they have global ambitions, and they just released another white paper on Latin America. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what the end game is with these infrastructure projects that have dual use. You think this is benevolent? You think this is charitable? You think this is ideological? Like everything, it is strategic. And so if you are America first, then you understand that the U.S. government, its first and only priority is to ensure the survival of the United States. We have to secure our vital strategic interests, which are geographical, which are the waterways and territory close to the United States. We want to prevent these weapon systems from getting too close to us, whether they be containerized missile systems, nuclear missiles. We want to prevent China from getting information on us through these ports, radar dishes, whatever. We want to be prepared for the future of strategic competition with China. And so for that reason, I support this. I support the new Monroe Doctrine. What's more, it's cheap, it's quick, we got what we wanted, we got out. The last thing I'll say about all of it is, what is the future going to hold? And I said in the buildup to this operation, I said, I don't support an invasion of Venezuela. Venezuela is a big country, 29 million people. It's like about the size of Texas. The terrain is difficult. You have a lot of cities, a lot of jungle terrain. I don't think it's a good idea to put 100,000 troops in Venezuela in these guerrilla battles, fighting the remnant of the Maduro regime. I don't think that's a good idea. I don't even really think regime change is a good idea. I said last year, what I supported was the Rick Grenell deal. Rick Grenell worked out a deal where Maduro would remain, but he would give us their oil, give us their gold, change the laws, reorient from Beijing and Moscow to Washington. I said, we should just take the deal. Forget about the military intervention. Just take the deal. A military intervention will be costly, time-consuming, absorb energy. It's uncertain whenever you roll the dice like that. And it seems like what we got is something in the middle, which is we are doing the deal. Washington is working with this Venezuelan regime. This vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, is visiting. There isn't this immediate impetus for a democratic transition. We just want to work with them on these strategic interests. And you know what? Taking swift, decisive military action, if that puts the fear of God in these other countries, if a demonstration of force reinforces deterrence, diminishes miscalculations, incentivizes friends to cooperate, enemies to stand down, then I think that it's absolutely worth it. And you got to keep in mind, you know, a lot of people, they memorize these anti-war arguments. They said, war is always bad. Anything the government does is bad. It's all bad. It's all Iraq. Iraq was a ground war with 300,000 soldiers. It's still going on today, 25 years, costs us $3 trillion. This operation lasted 2.5 hours. It maybe cost $1 billion, okay? And do the math on that. $1 billion versus $3 trillion. I saw somebody today say, it's costing us $9 million a day. Do the math. Iraq cost us 3,000 times more. This cost us nothing. Okay, we sent $3.8 billion to Israel. It doesn't affect us. This is a $1 billion operation, lasted 2.5 hours. If it carries with it some benefit for the United States, pressure on Canada, pressure on Cuba, reinforced deterrence, put China on notice. And here's another thing. This operation took place when the Chinese delegation was negotiating with the Maduro regime. I don't know if that was an accident. Trump seems to do this all the time. He bombed Syria when the Chinese were at Mar-a-Lago, kidnaps Maduro when they're in Caracas. It puts them on notice too. And so I'm totally in favor of it, unless, of course, it goes off the rails. And Trump did say there's not a lot of certainty here about what comes next. Initially, Trump said, we will directly administer Venezuela. We're not opposed to boots on the ground. I don't like the sound of that. That sounds like an overcommitment. But if what this entails is a blockade, all we have to do is maintain a naval presence there. And that is just classic gunboat diplomacy. We get them to do what we want. Stop sending oil to Cuba. Send less of it to China, more of it to us. Let ExxonMobil come in or whatever. Then I'm in favor of it. And I think that it's easily defensible under America First. But as I said before, the problem is so many of you people, and I'm speaking to many of you, but in general, so many people that have come to criticize Israel, they never let go of their ideological priors. As the last thing I'll say, then we'll get into super chats. Last thing I'll say is this. So many people got involved. You got red-pilled last year. You got red-pilled 2 years ago. I've been doing this for 10 years. Other people have been doing it longer than that. Some people got red-pilled a year ago, and they were liberal normies. Disgruntled liberal normies. And why did they come over? They said Israel's committing a genocide. That's true. It's barbaric. It has to do with Jewish supremacy. But of course, the real problem with America is that we have a Jewish oligarchy that is making us pay for it. They couldn't do it without us paying for it. And so properly understood, this has everything to do with nationalism. It's from an America First axiom. You say, how can a country put its people first if it has this parasitic class, if it has this fifth column of people that are loyal to another state and seem to be operating their own ethnic policy to rise through the ranks, gain power in the United States, and then use our country for the benefit of some other country or for the Jewish community at large. But many people that got involved are simply being manipulated by, as I said, ideological communists, liberals, Islamists. Muslims hate Israel because their homeboys are being killed. They hate America too. I saw Sneeko did an interview with Daniel Hakikajo, who's a Muslim. And, you know, he's a nice guy. I've talked to him before. I don't hate the guy. But he says to Sneeko, you know, the West has terrorized the world for 200 years. They need to be knocked down a peg. Is that America First? A Muslim with allegiance to foreign countries that has this axe to grind because of his own tribal. Is that America First? No. But it's people like that that have ideologically captured disgruntled normies. Disgruntled normies say, hey, sums up with Israel. And they're downloading all this content from disgruntled Muslims, commies. I look at a guy like Jeffrey Sachs, Max Blumenthal. You two are on notice. Max Blumenthal and Jeffrey Sachs, they make appearances on Judge Napolitano, Tucker Carlson, but they're both left-wing Jews. So Max Blumenthal says that when ICE arrests illegals, he says that's terror capitalism. Terror capitalism. Okay, so what are you, some kind of fucking Jew communist? Oh, but he's really based on Israel. Yeah, he's based on Israel because he's a liberal and he thinks that Netanyahu is like the white supremacist of Israel. My first exposure to Max Blumenthal is when he did a hit piece about David Irving for the SPLC 20 years ago. Anybody catch that? Or did you just catch him on Judge Knapp because you were born yesterday? You know, when you were reading The Gray Zone and watching Max Blumenthal, I'm sure you saw all of his intense and fact-based takedowns of Israel. Did you catch the part when he was calling Dave Irving a Nazi for the SPLC 20 years ago? Did you catch that part? Or what's going on there? How about Jeffrey Sachs, another Jew, another liberal Jew? He's crying, literally blood coming out of his eyes, crying and shitting and pissing his pants about how bad Israel is. He's literally shaking. And he's so mad we went into Venezuela. What did he say in Serbia a couple weeks ago? He said, the era of European domination is coming to an end and it can't come soon enough. Just rub your hands together, Jeff. Jeff, Max, just rub your little hands together. Jeffrey Sachs. Oh, he's based on Israel. I'm on Tucker. I'm on Judge Knapp. I'm literally shaking about how mad I am about Netanyahu. Watch his other stuff. These people are not our friends. Liberals, leftists, communists, Islamists, not our friends. Marriage of convenience, propel an Israel critical narrative, like, okay, sure. But at the end of the day, you know, if a right-wing nationalist faction takes power and we throw off Israel, these Muslims are going to want to stay. And they're still mad. Okay, and these left-wing people, they're not going to want us to get our way in the world. They're going to want us to petition the United Nations. Hey, can we please do what we want? And that's not America First. So, you know, a lot of people got it twisted and said, oh, my only defining characteristic is it's just Jews in Israel. And it's like, no, it's Jews in Israel because I'm America First, because I'm an identitarian. We are part of European Christian civilization. We are citizens of the United States of America. We have an identity. We have interests. We should put ourselves first. Stop blaming ourselves. Stop being ashamed of ourselves. Stop rooting for our own demise. Stop listening to people that hate us, whether they're liberal Jews, billionaire Jews, whether they're Muslims, whether they're Jewish communists, We have to stop listening to people that hate us, that are trying to get us to advocate against our own best interests. I'm not going to be the white guy at a fucking BLM protest. I'm not going to be a white guy in a keffiyeh at a pro-Palestine protest. And I said that very vocally. I'm going to be a white guy putting America first. Okay? So that is increasingly a problem, and I've identified that. And that's why I say this year is going to be a year of refining our ideology, because it's cropped up in a few different ways. Charlie Kirk gets killed by a leftist, because that's real. There are tranny leftist pieces of shit that want to kill Charlie Kirk because he's a transphobe. Whatever you believe about what happened, they all celebrated. But all these, but the communists and the Muslims said, no, blame it on Israel, because they don't give a shit about that. And when this woman got shot in the face, when she got mag dumped by ICE, all the usual suspects, oh, this is like, no, ICE is like the Zionist police force. They were trained by the IDF. Trained by the IDF. This fucking stupid bitch wants you dead. Like, if we gave the country to her, she would crash it into the rocks intentionally and giggle while she did it. Like, are you kidding me? Yes, we want mass deportations. No, I don't care if some libtard protester gets shot because she blocks federal law enforcement. And no, I don't think that Venezuela has anything or much to do at all with Zionism. So it needs to be put in its proper place. I'm not captured by that. I won't let this movement be captured to that. You want to be an anti-colonialist, you want to be an Islamist, you want to, you know, raise up your stick for Yahya Sinwar, knock yourself out. I raise up the American flag. I raise up the cross. It is about what is best for America. It is about what is best for people with our passports, what our ancestors did, what is good for our posterity. That's a Monroe Doctrine. That's what the America First Committee said 80 years ago. Hemispheric defense. That's our strategic doctrine.